Hi, everybody. I'm Andy. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is March 21st, 2007. And I have a home group, and that's the Common Solution Group in Charlottesville. I drove up here tonight with a friend of mine from my home group. And, you know, I really love my home group. And when I first came to AA, I think I had a lot of friends, a lot of people I called friends, but I really didn't have connections in my life. And I do today. And it started really in a home group for me, understanding how to do that. So I have a sponsor, and I sponsor at least one person right now. I guess I'll start. I've spoken here a couple times before, and I remember both times just being so nervous, you know. And I wrote up with James today, and I felt really calm, and sat down here, and like 5 minutes before the meeting started, there it comes again, and now I'm nervous again. I thought I had grown, you know, past this. But, you know, it's a simple truth that I've learned here, and I learned it in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that, you know, I suffer from self-centered fear, and this thing that I learned it when I did my fourth step, is that I am terrified of what other people think of me. And I behave poorly, and I have all these terrible decisions that result in just catastrophe because of that fear, you know. And I'm dishonest, you know, I'll lie, I'll tell you whatever you want to hear. So the reason I'm saying that right now is I want you all to know that my purpose right here, right now, is to be as honest as I possibly can and just share my experience. Cool. I love speaker meetings, and I don't get to a lot of speaker meetings in Charlottesville for whatever reason. But it's really great because, like, we hear different experiences. People have different outcomes. They come from different places. But every time I'm at one, and if I'm listening, I always find something in what that person's sharing that I connect with, you know. And it's always alcoholism. That's why we're here together. And I don't know why that still surprises me, but I think it's a really cool thing. So I grew up in Northern Virginia, outside of D.C. I went to school up there, and I had a pretty normal upbringing. And a lot of the stories I'll hear in AA, sometimes we talk about, you know, broken homes and a lot of sadness, you know, around family structure. And that wasn't my experience. And in fact, looking back on it, you know, I had parents that, above all, they wanted to give me everything that they thought I needed. And that included love and support. And but there was something in me, I think, from earliest age, where it was just, it's almost like a dissatisfaction with everything. I can look back on that stuff now, and I can realize that I was really always consumed with how I felt, you know, about everything. And I have this experience that I remembered this once I was in AA, but I was a little kid, and I was, I'm going to say about 7, 8, 9, something like that, sitting on the front stoop of the house. And I think my parents were out doing some yard work. And I just remember being so, like, down and, like, depressed. And I felt sadness, you know. And I was thinking about this, and it felt so awful, you know. And it was probably something as stupid as, like, I had to go to school the next day, right? But none of the, like, the reality, the facts matter. You know, it was just, I felt this bad. And I started thinking about it, and I thought that I had felt that bad before. And then I started thinking that, you know, I'm going to feel that bad again. And I started thinking about, you know, how much time do I feel good in between those times? And it's like I came up with a little math problem, and it's like the equation balanced is that I feel worse than I feel good. And so I'm this little kid with this terrible, crushing weight, you know, on him, sitting on the front porch while his parents are doing yard work. And I reached over, and I grabbed this bottle of some kind of chemical thing that I think they're like an additive for the weed poison stuff. And like had the little Mr. Yuck sticker on it. You know, they used to have those little green stickers. And I thought I was going to kill myself or what I thought, but I just, you know, took this thing and immediately, you know, started crying and I'm upset. And turned out I was fine, like nothing happened. But after I've been in AA a while and I was starting to learn about some of this like self-centeredness and this focus on feelings and always how I feel is the most important thing at any moment. You know, I remembered that. And I remembered that that way of thinking was present at that early, early stage in my life. And that those kind of decisions I made based on those feelings really, you know, affected my entire outcome after that. So, you know, I went through school and, you know, I'm the type of guy that I always had people around me, you know, and I got really good at knowing what people wanted to hear to make them laugh. I could tell you the right joke. And I get these real kind of like tight groups of guys, you know, these friends, and I would become like kind of the center of attention. And what happened to me is if you ever took somebody new into that group, like if there were four of us and you added a fifth, I would have to shut down. I wouldn't know what to do. I wouldn't know what to say. I wouldn't know how to hold my hands. I would just be terrified. And it would just throw me for a loop. And so I started having these things. I felt like maybe I had a lot of friends, but I never really had any real connections with other people, you know. It's like what was most important for me wasn't to have that real connection. It was to look like I was liked, you know, and to look like I was part of something bigger. And in reality, looking back on it, I think I was very alone during a lot of that. So went through high school in Northern Virginia, and I didn't drink too much. I drank a little bit. And, you know, the first time that I drank was probably with some guys on a weekend. And the reason why we did it is just because it was like the bad thing to do. You know, it was like we'd sneak this stuff out. Somebody had a fake ID, and we'd go and we'd have fun. And it was kind of just like this rebellious kind of thing. And that was it. It wasn't because, you know, I'm trying to drink away my sorrows. It was just like, it was kind of a cool thing to do. And so I remember doing that a few times, and it wasn't earth-shattering. And so I graduated high school, and I came up going to school down here in Central Virginia to college. And I kind of always think back on this first night that I was at college. And what happened is that we went, you like unpack all your stuff, you know, in your dorm room, and you're meeting all the people that live on your hall and your roommates and all of that and getting settled in. And for me, like going to college wasn't, I know what the purpose is, right? You're supposed to come here and you're supposed to learn, you're supposed to get a degree and get trained, you know, to give something back to society afterwards. But all I cared about was really this fact that I'm away from mom and dad and I don't have rules around me. And it was awesome. It was really exciting. And I remember, so we're getting settled in and some upperclassmen come down the hall and they were talking about, hey, we're going to have this keg party out at this fraternity house, you know. I'm like, we'd love for you guys to come. And so, like, all right, this is going to be great. And so I remember I got my buddy, and we went and we got all the girls that we knew that went to our high school so we could show up with girls, you know, so that we'd be welcomed in. And I think they said that, you know, it would start at like 8, and I'm certain we showed up at like 7:30. You know how that is, or I do. I was just so eager to be doing this thing. And so I get there, and it was one of those places where they've got these big decks, like kind of down on the ground level. And there's like a keg in the trash can, you know, with ice all around it, and it's tapped. And there's the big stack of the red plastic cups. And I remember going up on this deck, and there's benches around it. And I remember sitting there and looking over across the deck to this group of guys that, you know, maybe sophomores or juniors or seniors, and thinking, oh my God, what am I doing here? And I look at these guys, and they look like men, you know, they look like, the way they just carried themselves, they look like a completely different type of person than I was. And I realized, like, I've made a terrible mistake, I don't know what to do here, these, you know, and I'm surrounded by these, I thought it was going to be cool, these girls, you know, and I'm completely crippled, I cannot communicate with them, I can't do anything. And the keg of beer is there, and so, you know, we all just start filling up our cups as we're sitting there drinking and drinking and drinking. And I think what starts to happen is I notice that I'm no longer, like, consumed with what these people are doing across the deck. And I'm starting to talk to the people. We're starting to joke. And then I notice it's, you know, there starts to be a group around me. And, like, and people are laughing. We're having a good time. And then I was just like, some of the people are girls, you know. And it's like everything's happening. And it just feels like I am completely who I'm supposed to be right now. I'm connecting to all of these people. I feel like I know what I'm supposed to be doing, and it's this. And everything just feels right. And I heard a speaker in AA, and he said this. And the first time I heard him say it, I didn't understand what it meant. But later, I remembered it, and it came back to me. And he said the reason he drank is because it made him feel the way that men look. And so I thought back of me standing on that deck. And I'm like, that was it. It was like I had no purpose. I had no idea why I wanted to be here. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know anything. But I drank because it made me feel precisely that way that those other men looked, you know. I was comfortable in my own skin. I had a purpose. And I liked who I was. And so from that moment on, it just was a complete shift. Everything became about drinking. And so as you can imagine, like, focus on school, on studies, all of that stuff would slip away. And repercussions would start to come up, you know. Just to give you a few list of things, you know, that started happening. We used to go on spring break. We'd go on these trips to different college towns. Meet up with people using non high school. And one time we went to Vanderbilt. It's exciting. And I don't know how the night started, but it ended up where me and a buddy were walking back through Vanderbilt University and walked across this baseball field. And we saw they had, you know, those like 4x6s, actually, the little gator vehicles they take injured players off the field with. There was one sitting out in center field. And so we were like, well, let's see if this is operable. And we went, and sure enough, keys were in it. We fired it up, and then driving it around, you know, having a good old time on the baseball field. And then we found out that the center field gate was open, so we could actually drive it out of the park. And we realized we could easily get onto the streets of Nashville. And so we're just cruising around town, and we basically stolen this vehicle and having a good old time. And, you know, saw some like cop lights and bailed it and, you know, hiked, you know, ran away, and thought we were in the clear. And sure enough, walked around this corner, and two cops came out and, you know, laid us on the ground and cuffed us and arrested us, took us in. And, you know, we found out that the value of that vehicle made this event a felony, you know. And so, you know, we stole a vehicle. And so we had to go, you know, go into jail. And I remember everything's like flashing in front of me, and I'm thinking, this is not the way I intended this evening to end. And I had the little felony wristband on, so like some of the other people in jail were like shying away from me, like, ooh, that's the... And, you know, I'm just terrified. And I remember this one, I used to have really long hair at the time, and this guy came through, and he had... It's funny now, I wasn't laughing then, but he goes, how the hell did they nail MacGyver? Because that was cool. And, but you know what happened in that situation is what happened always for me. It's that I skated, you know, and I got away. And it turned out that someone in my family knew someone who knew someone at the university, and they knew who the right lawyer to call and pull some strings, and got me and my friend out of there with no more, you know, repercussions than having to fold donated clothes at a, you know, for community service somewhere for a series of weekends. And now when I was in there, that place, you know, I remember this is how awful this was. And it became very clear to me how my actions were, what was happening. And I remember that feeling of not being in control of where you can physically be at any time and what that felt like. And like to remember that, you know, and, you know, not, I got to cut back on this drinking thing. And remember when I got kind of clear of all of that stuff, it just felt like, well, it was no big deal anymore. You know, it's no big deal. Now, about that time, I started having a lot of fun, too, with alcohol. You know, I also want to tell you guys, it wasn't all awful. Inhibitions were gone. I felt like I could connect to people. And I started to play music in this band around town. And have a lot of fun. I could get up on stage and do all of this, you know, performing in front of people. And it was really exciting. I met, you know, and started dating the woman I eventually married. So a lot of good things came out of this experience. But, you know, what eventually happened is I didn't go to class. And so I got a letter from the university that says, we don't want you to come back next year. And also at this time, too, as part of this fraternity, I had run for elected office in the fraternity. and they had elected me the president of the fraternity. And I was laughing about it because I was in an AA meeting like a few months back, and there's a reading in the 12th step of the 12 and 12, and it says, you know, every boy dreams of being the president of the United States. And it goes on to talk about like service and what service means in Alcoholics Anonymous, this idea of giving without wanting anything in return. And so I look back on that and being the president of that, or, you know, student council in school, anything like that. The purpose was never to give anything to anybody. Like that, I wasn't even aware enough to think that was the purpose, that I even needed to pretend that was why. I just wanted to be that guy, and I wanted to put that thing on my resume, and I wanted to be liked, and I wanted it to be validated that this guy was elected, so he must be great. And that was it. And so it's funny, and I mean, I look back, and I was like, how could I be so dense and not realize what service actually meant, you know? And so anyway, I get kicked out of school. I'm in this position at the fraternity, and I remember going to the guys and saying, trying to convince them to let me stay as the president of this fraternity, even though I'm no longer in school there. Like, I was that kind of clouded that I thought that was crazy. So eventually a kid got, you know, left town and went back, and I was the youngest of three kids in my family, so my parents had kind of moved on with raising kids. You know, once I had left, they kind of thought it was over. So when I kind of came back home, they had to put their plans on hold for a little bit. And, you know, that's something else I didn't think twice about, really. During that time, too, my sister kind of put her neck out on the line and got me a job working at the company she worked at. And, you know, I really took advantage of that time. And I had this opportunity. I worked downtown in D.C. and worked on site with the Department of Defense as a contractor. And they had just moved office buildings into this new facility. And so it felt like acres and acres of empty cubicles in this building. And they slowly, over time, they were phasing in workers into these different areas of the building. And so when I was there, it was like 90% empty. And I would roll into work every day. I'd ride the train in. And by the time I got there, I was just kind of coming out of the fog, where I didn't really feel drunk anymore from the night before. And but I just, all I wanted to do at that point was to sleep. So what I would do is I would look around and I would try to sneak away when no one was looking, and I'd find a distant cubicle. Like, I mean, it looked like a science fiction movie. It was just like rows and rows of cubes. I'd go and I'd hide, and I'd get under this desk and I'd sleep for like 3 hours. And I remember I'd wake up in the morning, like 3 hours later, and I would kind of have this sweat. It would break, and I would feel like all the alcohol is coming out of my pores. And it felt great. I felt refreshed. And then I would go and I'd do a good 2.5-3 hours of work and then go home. And I would get off the train, and on my way home from the train station to the house, I started to stop at this little bar, this little restaurant that had a bar up front. And I thought this was really cool, and it just felt right. It had this, like, I had like a seat that I was always at. And there were five other people, and they were always there, seemed like every day. And we were all very different people, but we were always there drinking. And I just really started to drink more and more and more every day. And eventually this period of time passed, 1 year, and I could come back to school. So what I had learned was that I could drink a lot and still make it to work on time. And so I applied that thinking to coming back to school, and it worked. So I was able to get up and make it to class on time, which is really how I messed up before. I didn't go to class. So I got that done, and I graduated, and I guess everything's looking up. So I, about that time, I was getting more serious with a girlfriend that I was seeing, and we decided to move out to a log cabin out in Gordonsville, about a half an hour outside of Charlottesville. And it's beautiful. It's like 300 years old, falling apart. In the mornings, you'd go up the stairs and you could see light beams that were coming in from outside. And it was just the perfect place to drink. And she would work and I would drink. And then, you know, I eventually got a job in town, and so I started doing the daily commute in and out. And so what happened there, I really started escalating with the drinking, was on every time I get off work, I would, I used to get two 22s at the same gas station coming out of town. And I'd drive, you can actually go dirt roads, like all the way from Charlottesville if you go over the little mountain to get back out to where we were. And so I'd know all the little back roads, and I'd go and I'd just drink. And then eventually those would turn into 40s. And it was just like any time, I just couldn't be alone in the car for like half hour. Couldn't even think about that. And sometimes I'd have to take trips up to D.C. And then on the way home from there, I'd always stop at Manassas on 66. And I'd go and I'd get a 12-pack. And I'd see how fast I could drink that coming down 29. And it was usually somewhere around in here is where I'd run out. And I'd have to go get some more. And I remember trips coming home just drinking so much so fast that it was like my stomach would fill up with foam, and I'd have to stop and throw up. And it wasn't because I felt sick. It was just I was so full of beer. I was just consuming as fast as I could. Eventually, we moved back into town, and I started working from home, which really lets, you know, any block on the drinking is just gone. And so I knew the drinking was a problem, and I remember talking to, I got married during that time. And I'll tell you something, it's just scary and sad that I always pushed, never thought about before, but it came up in AA too, is that on our wedding night, we got married out in Crozet, and I drove us home in a blackout, you know. It's crazy to think about that. So we moved back into town, a little house there, and I would start this cycle of disappointing everybody around me, hurting people, you know, just general damage, and saying I'm not going to drink anymore, or I'm going to learn how to drink the right way, I'm going to do it right, you know. And it was just this constant failure, and then this attempt to redeem myself and then fail. And the cycle would just get tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter. And, you know, where it eventually got is that I would, she would be at work, and it would be about 3 o'clock, and I'd realize if I'd run out to the gas station right now, I could get two 12-packs, and I could drink that first 12-pack before she got home. And the reason why that's important is because I could drink the first beer out of the second 12-pack. And so when she smelled beer, she'd think, oh, that's just his first beer. And so then I would do that, and I would then she'd come home, and so I'd drink kind of through the evening. And, you know, whatever you might want to call dinner, you know, at that point nothing's really going on as a couple, you know. And, you know, eventually she'd want to go to bed. And all she would want to do, and this happened over and over and over again, all she would want to do is for me just to come to bed and lay beside her so she could see me just like in the day, just stop. And that is the last thing I wanted to do. So I would just come up with excuses why I had to watch this certain thing on TV, you know, some sports thing she didn't get, or there was always some reason. And I would sit on the couch, and I'd look at the TV, and I would look down the hallway, and our bedroom was down at the end of the hallway. And what she would do, she'd go in there, and she'd close the door, and she'd turn on her little reading lamp next to the bed, and she would read. And so I'd sit on this couch, and I'd just be staring down there, and I'd see the light kind of spilling out from underneath the crack under the door, and I know she was still reading. So then I'd look back at the TV, and like, okay, wait 10 minutes, you know, look back down. She's still up. And eventually it would happen. I'd look down there, and there was no light under the door, and I knew she's out. And I just, everything was good. I've heard people talking to AA about this, like the anticipation of the drink, you know, it was better than the actual drink itself. And I'm like, that can't be right. But, like, you know what? Knowing that I am free to drink the way I want to drink was just the greatest feeling. And I would get up, and I'd go, you know, to the cabinet to either get, like, the Evan Williams, which for some reason I was really into, or, you know, bottles, whatever it was, and I would spread them out in my fingers so they wouldn't clink. And I'd go over to the door and edge my way out onto the porch, and I would sit out there, and usually just in darkness, and just smoke cigarettes and just drink to oblivion. And I don't remember being mad or angry or resentful or anything. I just remember drinking to oblivion. And I'd wake up and I'm in bed. And I look over and she's next to me and I'm like, oh my God, I did it again. I cannot believe it. And I'm filled with shame. And then I'm also thinking, what did I do? Did I go out after, you know, I started drinking? I'd have to kind of, you know, did I wreck? Did I hurt anybody? And just the shame, I just feel like, oh my God, I cannot believe I've done it again. And I would make this promise to myself. You know, I didn't have a relationship with God or anything like that, you know. But I'd make a promise to somebody or myself. I don't know. But I was like, I'm not going to do this anymore. And it's for good intentions. I love these people around me, and I see what I'm doing. I'm destroying this. And I would make that honest promise. And then we'd get up, whatever fight would happen, you know, because of what happened the night before. And then she'd go off to work, and I would basically get the greasiest food I could find and cram it down to soak some of that stuff up and then maybe nap. And then about noon, I'd have to sweat, and it would break, and everything feels good. And, you know, I was doing some work, you know, getting my mojo back. And about 3, I'm like, man, if I go get 2 12-packs right now, you know, I can finish the first one and have just one before she came in. And it was like, it just made sense. Like, the thing that I was talking about earlier in the morning just didn't seem like a big deal. And that's the way it went. And so it went around and around. People around me, like, I don't think they could understand. And unless they're alcoholic, like what I was doing, right? They didn't understand it. I would come home from being out with my wife sometimes, and we'd be out for a long time, and everybody's drinking, having a good time. I was having a lot to drink. And as soon as we came in the house, I have to go right to the cabinet or right to the fridge to get a drink. Because for me, it's like that was all the precursor, the stuff I had to suffer through, so that we could get back here and now get down to business. And they just don't get that, never understood that. And I don't know how anybody could. So eventually, you know, as you could imagine, she got fed up, and anybody would. And she had said she'd had enough, and she left. And she was going to see her mom. And I was distraught, because I'm like, oh my God, you know, this is a promise. I'll never do this again. And a promise doesn't carry much weight when you've been promising like almost every day, you know, about different things that you never carry out. And, but I had like this, I had a plan. And this was like the final solution. This is what I was going to do when it all got bad. So she's driving up, and I called her up and I said, I am serious this time, because I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she was like, well, fine, good luck. And, so that's why I came to AA. It wasn't because I didn't even know what an alcoholic was. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't believe that I was going to stop drinking if I came to AA. And I don't even know if I really was interested in stopping drinking through AA. I really, at that moment in time, I wanted my wife to come home. And whatever con job and whatever lie I could make to get her to come home, I was going to do it. And for me, that was, I was going to come to AA. And so I came. And I went to my first meeting, and it was a Friday night meeting at in Charlottesville. And, you know, I've been to that meeting many times since, and I got to tell you, sometimes that meeting is wild, and there's craziness going on, and sometimes I leave it thinking, that meeting didn't help anybody. You know, now that I know, of course it did, and it helped me because it was there that night, and I showed up, and I went there. And, it's funny how this, like, ego rebuilds in AA, and all of a sudden I know what I'm doing, you know. And so I went to this meeting, and I started to go to AA meetings. And one thing everybody was talking about was you had to get a sponsor. And so I asked this guy to sponsor me, and he said no. He said, I've got too many people that I'm sponsoring, I can't do it. But here's what I'll do. You should go talk to these guys. And so he hooked me up. He said, go to this meeting on this night and meet these guys. And at that point, I'm thinking, I thought anybody wouldn't say no, you know. So I got it in my head. I was like, well, I'm gonna get, you know, a sponsor here. So I started going to this meeting, and these people were talking a lot of things about AA. They sound a little bit different than some other meetings. They're really talking about actions and solutions, and they had something going on because they seemed like happy and comfortable in their own skin, and it wasn't just all about awful problems that were going on. And I saw enough of that. I saw that there was something there that was happening. And so what I did is I thought, well, I picked out this guy that I was going to ask to be my sponsor. And I really thought that I was going to, like, make this guy's day, you know, because I'm like the new person in AA. And I'm like, great potential. I'm full of potential, you know, and like, oh, what a great opportunity. And so I go up to this person and I'm like, all right, you know, I think I want you to be my sponsor. And he was like, well, we can talk about it. And I'm like, well, that's not really the response I was thinking. But so what he did is he said, well, why don't you meet me at this location and at this time and we can talk about it. So I was a little put off by that, and I didn't know what that was all about. And so then I said, and of course I went and I met this guy there and we talked. And now I know what he did is, like, he gave me my first suggestion in AA. You know what I mean? He gave me my first commitment, really. And I think he wanted to see if I'd be willing to make a commitment like that. Because what I've seen in AA is, like, my experience here has been a series of commitments. And my willingness to carry through with those, I think, is what's kept me sober here. So anyway, I met with this guy, and he said, well, I'd be happy to sponsor you, but I'm just going to ask you a few things that I ask all of the people that I sponsor. And if you're willing to do these things, I have no problem, you know, sponsoring you. I was like, okay. And he said, well, first, are you willing to go to any length? I was like, oh, yeah. And, you know, since this time, I've asked guys sitting on the other side of the aisle that I'm working with the same question, and nobody has ever said no when you ask them, are you willing to go to any length? Everybody's like, yeah, sure, I'll do whatever you say. So I said yes, and he said, I want you to go to 4 meetings a week, and he said 2 of them are going to be committed, and what that means is that you're at that meeting every week. And he said, you're going to get a home group, and he told me what a home group was. He said, this is a meeting that you're at every week, and you are part of this group of people that help put this meeting on. You get a job in that meeting, and you're always there. And I said, okay, no problem. And he said, you're going to call 3 alcoholics a day. I was like, all right, this is really getting to be some kind of list here. And so he gave me these suggestions. And I basically said, yeah, sure. And that's about all I did. And then I just kept going to meetings, hoping that I wouldn't see this guy at the meeting. And this is my honest experience, is that there was a time maybe I wasn't going to so many meetings, and he hadn't seen me when he had expected to see me. And he called me and he's like, you know, how's it going? You know, I didn't see you at wherever. And I just turned in that phone. I said, listen, it's obvious that you called here with an agenda. So why don't you just get to it? And, and I know his agenda. His agenda was that he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's my sponsor. You know, and he's calling to make sure I'm okay and carry the message of AA. That's his agenda. And pretty clear. But I can't handle it. You know, a friend of mine in AA that I respect says, and this happens to me all the time, and now I know why. Sometimes I hear people ask me questions or talk about things in AA, and it makes me uncomfortable. I get that way when they're talking about things that I'm not doing. Every time. That's all it is. And, you know, it makes me uncomfortable. So, I snapped. One time, I came into my home group meeting. And afterwards, he pulled me aside and he goes, come here. And he said, you know, you shouldn't come to your home group meeting dressed like that. And I was like, whoa. And I was like, I know something about AA. I know there's not a dress code. And I looked at him and I said, listen, this bathing suit is brand new. You know, it was a gift. And it probably cost more than whatever, you know. And I remember, I was so mad, I just turned and like bolted out. And the next time I was at my home group meeting, I wasn't wearing a bathing suit. Let me tell you that. And so started to take little suggestions, but you know what? Something didn't stick. And I felt, the easiest way I can say it is that I felt different. And there were people in here that seemed to get it because the lights were on in their eyes. You know what I mean? Like you could look at them as like, bam, they were there. And it's like, you were those guys on the other side of the deck and I'm still over here, you know? And I started to get really uncomfortable because I thought I don't belong here. And around the house, I started to, I keep referring to things my sponsor tells me, but you know what, that's cool. My sponsor says, you know, sometimes and he knows things are a little off when he starts to become right in his relationships. And I started to become very right in all of my relationships. I was right. And if I'm right, you're probably wrong. And so around the house, I started to become very right. And I started to become very intolerant. People couldn't stand me. Work things were going awful, and I just started to feel terrible. I started to feel more different than anybody in AA, and I started to separate, and I just could not be comfortable in my own skin. And for me, it got so crazy that I started thinking again. It's like I was doing that equation on my front stoop where it's like, now I tried to drink and I tried to control how I drank. I tried not to drink. I tried to do all this stuff. And it ended up where I couldn't do it. I was so filled with shame every morning, I just wanted to end it. And now I've come here in AA and I've given it my all. You know, I'm not drinking. I have a sponsor. I can tell you his name. And, you know, I'm not getting credit around the house for not drinking. I'm doing this for you. You know, it's like, what do I get? You know, so what gives? You know, it's like, this doesn't work. I can't drink. And I clearly, this AA thing and not drinking, this isn't working. Because I still I cannot stand living right now. And I went to a meeting and there was somebody that shared some of the meeting that I'm sure that they had shared like 100 times. And I'm sure I heard it 100 times, but it never got in my ears. And they said, for an alcoholic, alcohol wasn't their problem. It was their solution. And he said, if you take alcohol away, problem, it's not going to get better. And in fact, it might get a lot worse. And so for the first time, I heard that and I really listened and I heard it. And what it meant for me in that place was that I knew that my problem wasn't different from anybody else's problem in that room. And for the first time, I realized that my problem wasn't alcohol. It was the fact that I couldn't live without alcohol. And you all shared this same problem. And so for the first time, I was just, I'm just an alcoholic. I'm not Andy with some special issue. And you know, it was really cool. Is at that point, I just realized, I'm like, this, could it be that simple? And so all I had to do was basically call up my sponsor and be like, listen, man, I got to get completely honest with you, you know? And so from that point forward, I basically just turned my life over to the care of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just said, yeah. Now, I don't mean to tell you guys that now as if like I've been the most perfect person in AA ever. I've got guys in here that know me well and they know that's not true. But what I did at that point is I just quit fighting and I quit the debate society and I, you know, whatever you say, because I knew, like, what do I have to lose? There's like two sides. I could live it out there drinking and I found out I can't, and I could just try not drinking and I realized I can't do that either. So what do I got to lose? And so I just started doing this stuff, you know, and it's been really awesome. I told you guys a little bit at the beginning about like home group and what it's been to learn how to be a part of something else. I feel like my whole life I've been on a list of names for different groups, but I've never really been a part of it. And sometimes it's cool to think that I can go sit in a church basement and be be engaged in something. Like whether or not we're going to serve cookies on our table next week. You know? And to learn how to just like keep my mouth shut and to be a part of something else, you know. And I've learned here in AA, and some, I heard a speaker say this once, that there is one problem that covers all problems and one answer that covers all answers. And, you know, the problem is separation from, the conscious separation from you, from God, and from everything. And the one answer is, you know, it's unity. And it's hard to believe when I came in here, because I fancied myself a very smart person. And it's just really hard to think that my problem could be something so simple as that, and that any solution could be that easy for somebody like me. But all I can tell you is that my experience has been, when it became that simple, my life got a lot better. You know, I mentioned that my wife came home, and she did, and we're still married today, and we have a kid, and he's a kid. That's right, we've got a kid. I have a son, and he is 4 years old, and it's just really cool to think that, like, I've been sober his entire life, and when my wife and I talk about parenting stuff, and I say she's a member of Al-Anon, and when we talk about parenting stuff, you know, I don't bring to the table anger, and I don't bring to the table, you know, these like instinctive, like this fight feelings that I get sometimes. What I try to bring to the table is like Alcoholics Anonymous. I try to bring things that I learned when we talk about like our both traditions here. And it's really cool. It's given me a completely different perspective on life. And, you know, where that stuff came from for me, like I said, was once I just became a member of the group here. And then the next thing to do, you know, once I got together with that sponsor, is to take the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, there were a couple moments, I think, in that 12-step process for me that were pretty eye-opening. And for me, the biggest one was... one of the biggest ones, I mean, they're all just gigantic, but the thing of making amends. And I really got kind of hung up on that process before I got rolling on it. And I'll tell you that what I thought the amends process was that it was my opportunity to go back and hook up with you, and not like that, James, hook up with you to talk to you and to give you an opportunity to forgive me. And like, that sounds weird when I say that right now, but you know what? That's really what I thought it was. Is that I'm going to go and we're going to sit down and we're going to clear this up. Why? So that you can pat me on the back and tell me how proud of me you are, because I'm an AA now and I'm sober. And I'm going to get a gold star and I'm going to be your favorite again. And, you know, I never like told that directly to my sponsor, but I think he sensed that I kind of, this is my thinking, you know? And so I remember my sponsor being very clear about making amends, and that it was, the purpose was, this is what he told me, is to go back and to right the wrongs that I've harmed other people, that I've caused others. And so to do that, you know, I need to get really clear on what that harm is. And so he gave me like a list of instructions of what to do. And he said, you know, number one, you tell them how you've harmed them. And number two, you ask him if you've left anything out. And he said, number three, shut up. And, you know, he wrote this on the little piece of paper. And I thought it was like a little over the top that he needed to write this like that. And and then he said, ask him if you've left anything out. And then again, shut up. And then the last one was, ask him what you can do to make that right. So I went in there, and the first amends I did was with my sister, and that was pretty straightforward. And then I started to make amends to some places where I'd stolen merchandise, you know, and I'm like paying money back. And but I like carried a lot, and I mean, I guess a lot of us do, like these relationships with our parents, you know. And so I remember sitting down with my mom and sitting across the table from her, and you know, I had this little list in my head, and so I told her how I had harmed her. And you know, my sponsor had given me some ideas of how I can do that without taking like 30 days, you know, to list everything. She needed to know that I understood. So I remember listing those things out. And then, you know, you ask, have I left anything out here? And I swear, it's like somebody in my home group had called her and, like, given her a heads up that that question was coming. Because I was like, did I leave anything out? And she was like, well, now that you mention it. And she starts just listing these things. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, ugh. And here's what I'm thinking in my head is, no, no, you don't understand. That's not what I meant. Oh, I would never do that. That was his fault. You know, like all these things, these rebuttals. No, no, no. I'm not listening. But my sponsor had been so clear about this thing, which I thought was over the top, is that I was supposed to just be quiet and listen. And so I remember I had my hands actually put them under my rear end, and I'm just sitting there listening. And what I heard is like the Charlie Brown, like the wah-wah, 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 wah. And after about like 15, 20 seconds, I started to hear a woman talking. And it's like I had never heard my mom as like a person, as like a human, a woman. And like she had always been to me like a cartoon character, really like the Charlie Brown cartoon. I never thought of her, it sounds crazy, right? But I never considered this person to be their own human person. And so I see this woman sitting across from me and I see her and I see that she has been hurt. And like I hear it from her and I start to understand for the first time, you know, the effect that my actions and my decisions have on other people. And so the weird thing about this is I thought I'm going in there to get forgiven, which, you know what, probably was a byproduct. But what really happened to me is that I forgave my mom by making amends to her. I realized for the first time, like, the level of hurt that I had caused and how I had, like, kept her out here, you know, and blamed so much on her. And so then we got to say, you know, like, what can I do to make that right? And the answer was she wanted a son back. She wanted somebody who could be at family dinners and not drunk. I couldn't drive from Charlottesville to visit my family without getting hammered. She wanted somebody that she could call and could talk to, you know, somebody that she could just, simple stuff. And so that's how I could make amends to her. And so I started to call her every week and I started to kind of rebuild that relationship. And so things like that sometimes happen. Things here in AA for me have been kind of like slow and gradual, but sometimes something will just hit me right across the face and I completely see things differently. It's like you flip the coin over. And you know, that was a big one for me. I'll just tell one more story real quick because I've eaten up a lot of time. I also have not been someone who has come in here and just gotten it right and has just sailed through. Now, I haven't had a drink of alcohol since I came to my... I haven't relapsed since I've been in AA. But I have done a lot of behaviors that I regret, you know. And I'll share a couple things with you real quick. So, one is I was going through this thing. I remember it was before my son was born, I think, and I was, I guess I was just getting right in my relationships a lot, you know. And I remember that I was at work and something happened on a teleconference call. And at the end of the call, bottom line was I didn't get credit for this project and somebody else did. And I was just a little upset by that. And I remember going home and kind of telling my wife about this and expecting, you know, some consolation. And she's just like, well, it doesn't really matter. You know, like, what's the big deal? And I was like, now I'm getting screwed at home. And then I remember she said, she had a phone like mine, and she needed to get a new cord for it because she had lost hers on a trip or something. And she had forgotten to get it. And she's like, can you go out and get it because I have to travel and I need this. You know, fine. I will be the glue that holds this family together. And so I go out to the store and I'm angry. And I remember going into the Best Buy in Charlottesville and I need the cord for the phone. And I'm just so mad at the idiot that laid out these stores because there's like cameras and phones and computers and they all have cables and like you don't know which one they go to. You'd think it'd be by the phones, but it's not. And so finally, I find the stupid chord that I want to find, and I'm not sure if it's going to fit. But I have the same phone that she does. So what I do is I open the box, and I plug it in my thing. I was like, oh, this fits. Okay, good. And I look at the box, and it's $40 for, like, a cable that's this long. And I'm like, you have got to be kidding me. These people are not going to also screw me. And so I took that cord. Oh, and by the way, I've been sober like 3 years at this point, and I'm Mr. AA. I'm in meetings talking about spiritual awakenings and solutions and how I'm recovered. And so I take this cord and I wrap it around my hand like this. I put it in my pocket. And I just walk right out of that store, and I'm feeling good. I'm thinking these guys are not going to get me too. And I went out, and I went and I gave her, here's your cord. And I remember going to meetings after that, and it was like I started to just be really uncomfortable, you know. And I was like, I need to talk to my sponsor about this, and I didn't want to tell my sponsor about it because like I was afraid of what he would think of me. You know, I was afraid that he'd think, how could he do this? You know, I've been working with this guy for 3 years. And so I didn't tell him. And so I remember just going to meetings and feeling more and more separate and more disconnected. And just wedging and wedging further apart. And God, I started thinking about that a lot. And I just didn't feel at home in AA, you know, which now I know that's probably as close as I've ever been to a drink because I was really on the outside of AA. I was in meetings, but I was really on the outside. And I go to a meeting and I hear this guy talking, and he's talking about being in being sober and working at a Greek diner and stealing baklava, of all things, and having to go back and having to cough something like that up to a sponsor and then going back and make amends for it. And here's the kicker in this guy's story. He did it again. And you know what I realized is that, like, once again, I'm like, I'm such an idiot. Like, I always think I'm so different. You know, I always think I'm so unique. And I think that I don't need to do the things that we all have to do here to stay sober. I don't need to tell my sponsor. I don't need to get honest. I'm different. I can fight my own battle here. And, you know, once again, I realize I'm just an alcoholic. I just have one problem, it's separation, and I have one solution, it's unity. So I go back to my sponsor, and I got honest with him, and you know, I had to go back and make amends for that. And, you know, I'm not proud of that, and the reason I share that with you is because I feel like I was at a point where I was really close to being outside of AA, and I didn't even know it. So I try, anyone asks me to ever tell my story, I try to work that one in just in case anybody's out there, and they feel like they're the only person in that spot, because you're not. One other story I'll tell you happened recently. It was funny. It was just a few months back. I was spiritual giant again. I'm leaving my house going to an AA event, and I remember I kind of cut off a guy in my neighborhood, and I had this little circular entrance in the neighborhood. And so I was going around this cul-de-sac thing and coming back, and the guy had stopped because I had cut him off, and he was, "You're going to run someone over," you know, he's screaming. And I remember being in my car going, "Well, that guy's spiritually sick, you know. I'm not even going to engage him. I'm going to take the high road." And then I remember going to that meeting and talking to people about it and being like laughing and being like, I cut this person off. I said, "Well, I didn't really cut him off, but he's sick." And so anyway, I go home and go to another AA meeting that weekend, and then I come back, and it's like 4 in the afternoon, and my wife comes home, and she goes, "Hey, Andy, did you see what somebody wrote on your car?" And so I go out to the street, and you know how people write "wash me" in the dirt? They wrote "kids beware" on the back of my car. I was like, my chest swelled up. I'm so mad because it's like somebody has vandalized my stuff, and they have labeled me. And I don't know how long people have been walking by my car and seeing that written on there, you know, and thinking, and that can have a lot of different meanings. And how dare someone do this stuff? And I am angry like I haven't been angry. I'm so mad. And I grabbed my dog's leash and put it on my dog and took him outside. And I knew who did that. it was that jackass that waved his fist out, and I know where he lives because I recognize that car. And so I grabbed the, I don't know if like the dog was like going to be like a buffer or something. I don't know what it was, but so I marched right down there, man. And sure enough, I see these people in that house, and I'm so mad. And I mean, I'm a lunatic at this point. And so, but something happened where I picked up my phone and I decided I should call somebody, and I did. I talked to somebody, and basically the message I got from them was, you probably should go home, you know. You probably should take the dog and go home. And I'm grateful that's what I did, because the next home group meeting I was at, there was a newcomer, and he had been coming around for a few weeks, and he had been part of that conversation I had had back on that Thursday night. And he goes, hey, Andy, did you see what I wrote on your car while I was sleeping?
No.
So, newcomers. But also, the moral is that I was so sure I was right. I was right. And you know what? It felt real. I was angry, but it felt really good to be right. And I almost barged into someone's house. You know? Justified. And, you know, I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful to be here. And Billy, thanks for asking me to speak.